So I guess how many of you are like sysadmin types? A couple. Okay. How many of you actually had to patch for Heartbleed? Okay. Now, by the way, raise your hands again. Now everybody look around. Okay. See all the hands that are up? Your hands should be up too, because you've got stuff that needs to be patched for Heartbleed. You just don't know it, which is what we're going to, one of the things we'll talk about today. Yeah. It's as close as it's going to get, I guess. That better? Okay. Actually, I used to street perform, so I'll demonstrate. I can actually talk loud enough that they can hear me in the Hyatt with no problem whatsoever. And I can do this all day long, much to the detriment of your eardrums. But I won't do that. I can actually talk louder than this, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah. It's... You learn to do that, or you don't eat, because they won't give you any money if they can't hear you. So yeah, for those of us who had to run around like crazed chickens, trying to explain to management, yes, there's this vulnerability. Yes, we're vulnerable. Yes, they can own our site, and no, we don't have a patch. That was a little annoying. However, once the patch did come out, in a fury of patching frenzy, we went and patched everything. At least that's what we thought, until we actually started digging in and finding out all the things that were vulnerable that are to Heartbleed that we didn't know about. And that's the problem, is nobody really knows what software you're running that is linked to the OpenSSL libraries that are vulnerable. But we'll get into that. Are we supposed to start right on time, or wait 5 minutes, or?
You can start.
Okay.
I think we can start already.
We can start now. Okay. Welcome to DragonCon 2014. Yay! Okay. You're excited now. Wait until the end of the week when you're so jazzed on caffeine, trying to stay awake, and you've seen just one too many guy dressed as Princess Leia. Okay. Yeah, that's, you know. And you accidentally did wander into the Harry Potter fanfic track session. That's, you know. So I'm Keith Watson. I'm the information security manager for the College of Computing. I work with some of the hacker spaces around here, like GeekSpace Atlanta right here. Anybody from Freeside? No, nobody from Freeside? Oh, those slackers.
Too early.
Yeah, it's too. Yeah, it's not noon.
They were all drinking last.
Yeah, that's right. And I also. Manage the DC 404, which is the local chapter of DEF CON. If you're not coming, you should. We talk about this kind of stuff all the time. I manage the email list, and also I'm the sponsor of Gray Hat, which is the Georgia Tech student organization for information security. They have a world-class capture the flag team that goes head-to-head with Carnegie Mellon and the Air Force Academy and whoops them soundly, which is really interesting because we let anybody play regardless of skill level. And we still trash them. Yeah, we rock. Tim.
I am Tim Farley. I work for a major company here in Atlanta doing information security, application security. So I can talk a little bit from the corporate standpoint, and if you want to grouse at me about how fast software companies patch their bugs, we can talk about that. And just what it looked like to have to actually respond to Heartbleed from a corporate standpoint, and somebody, you know, a provider of one of these sites that you're mad that they haven't patched it yet.
By the way, are there any other DC-404 here? I see one, two, another one. Wow, three. Yeah, I never see you at the meeting, so I don't recognize you. I didn't touch, it wasn't me. Andrew? Okay, so.
Okay.
We're going to cover today, we're going to cover what Heartbleed is, Heartbleed bug is, how do you fix it, and we're going to cover this briefly. This is not a systems administration 101 class. And then we're going to talk about some of the systemic weaknesses that were uncovered as a result of Heartbleed. These were weaknesses in our infrastructure that we were unaware of until they seriously got stress tested and we went, oops. Such as, is PKI, or public key infrastructure, is it broken? Poor detection, how do you know if you're safe or not, if the service you're using has patched? There was a huge challenge to Linus's law that came up, we'll discuss that. It was also uncovered that OpenSSL had poor software methodologies, This raised a great deal of concern in the industry at large, and we'll discuss that. And also about responsible disclosure, there was quite a flurry of activity online talking, debating the issue of whether Heartbleed was a textbook case of responsible disclosure or one of the worst ever. Let's just say there's very heated discussions online on that topic. Okay, how Heartbleed ticks. OpenSSL is a set of crypto libraries. There was a buffer over read bug in the TLS protocol heartbeat function. The heartbeat function is there to keep the session alive so it doesn't time out. And there was a bug in the way it was implemented. This is not a bug in the a failure of the actual protocol itself. That's defined correctly. It was just the implementation of it was incorrect. What the buffer overflow read lets you do is read past the area that you were assigned in memory for the heartbeat function. And when you read into other areas of memory, it allows you to recover things such as the private key used to encrypt the sessions. Now that's really, really bad. Are any of you not familiar with public key infrastructure or asymmetric cryptography? No one? Okay. Basically, you have two keys. You have a private, a public key. My private key, I give to no one. I go to a certificate authority, and he signs my key. You get a copy of that key from him with your browser. So that when you go to connect to, like, Amazon, for instance, I present you with a copy of my public key. You've got a copy of his public key. You can verify the signature on my public key that I hand you, and you know that it came from me. So it's okay to talk to me. And then we exchange with that key exchange, we exchange a symmetric key. We actually use symmetric cryptography for the encryption, the TLS encryption itself. So the problem is, if they're able to catch my private key, they can masquerade as me. This allows an attacker to literally read into the memory of the web server where the private key is in memory and snatch it out of memory, and that encrypted session is as clear text. At which point, if you imagine, you're logged into, say, your bank, they can see your user ID and password. I'm an admin and I'm using the administrative interface, it's secure, it's encrypted, right? I put in my admin credentials. If they capture those, they're now root on my box. It's really, really bad if they get the public key or the private key. Well, that's what they were able to do with this. On top of that, there's no logs generated by exercising this bug. The heartbeat function is a low-level protocol, and so it just keeps the internet connection alive. It's not something that gets passed up to the application layer, and as a result, it never ends up in a log anywhere. IDSs, which people started immediately sticking in front of their services, an IDS is an intrusion detection system, and some of them can be set to automatically block certain types of attacks, would look for the somebody doing a Heartbleed attack and block it. However, it's very easy to change the bit offset of the attack in the packet, and the IDS, it'll pass right through the IDS like it wasn't even there, and they'll have no idea that they've been hacked. And we'll give some examples of later on of articles that you can go through and read about where they actually did that. Now, by the way, in this presentation, you see all these blue links? Those are actual links to all the references that were used to put this presentation together. So if you want to go read more about it, you can click on every one of these links. You can get this. I'll have a link at the end of this that will show you where to get a copy of the presentation. It's not only in PowerPoint, it's also in PDF. The links are active in PDF as well. And at the end of this, obviously, if you have a reader that can't read these links for some reason, you would have no idea what the URL is. So at the end of this, I have all these references with the URL as an active link, and you can also just type it or copy it off the page and paste it into your browser. So you will be able to go read all these references. You don't have to take my word for it, okay? Netcraft, at the time of the event, which is back in April, did a study and said, hey, 17% of the sites on the internet, or of the 2.9 million sites, 500,000 were vulnerable to Heartbleed. That's banks, Amazon, everybody. Pretty much anybody using HTTPS. There are some other libraries available for doing TLS, and some people were using those, or they were using a version, an older version, that wasn't vulnerable to this particular attack. They were using the OpenSSL libraries, but they weren't using the vulnerable version. So some sites that we had were not vulnerable because we hadn't bothered to upgrade to the latest version of the software yet, because we do that like once a year where we do major version upgrades that don't have, if there isn't a security vulnerability that we're having to patch for, we don't necessarily patch because patching can break things. So we have to wait to a certain time of the year when we have low utilization, like around Christmas when all the students and faculty and everybody go home, and then we do all this major patching. So while everybody else is off getting beer, chasing women, and eating pizza, we're patching systems. So, except for this, we got to do it right in the middle of the cycle, which is terrible. Okay, the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Codenomicon both published detailed information about this attack and how it works and how to mitigate against it. So if you want to know how you can patch systems at home or what the process is in more detail, you can go to either one of those links and they have very detailed information on what you should do. Basically, the process consists of installing the patch, revoking your current certificates, creating a new public-private key pair, requesting new certificates, installing them, and once all that's done, notifying all your users that any user IDs, passwords, certificates, or keys that they used on your site may have been compromised and they have to change them. That's the process everybody had to go through. All 500,000 sites. How many of you got a notice to change your passwords? Most of you? I'm on every site that you go to?
No.
No. Okay. Are some of the sites you didn't get notices from making you nervous?
Yeah, my bank.
Your bank, right? Well, this is part of the problem. We had this same problem on campus where we had this one system we used for central authentication with a Kerberos backend for authenticating all of our processes. And we said, is that compromised? And we said, no, we're not using that version. So they didn't tell anybody they weren't using that version. They said nothing. And so as a result, people are like, do I need to change my passwords or not? No. Well, when are they going to come out and tell us we don't need to change our passwords? They're not going to. And so that's what happened, is your bank may not have actually been vulnerable. And since they weren't, they never said anything. What they needed to do was positive follow-up, where they said, no, you weren't vulnerable, you don't need to change your password, or yes, you did need to change it. And most every company did neither. They didn't tell you if you did, and they didn't tell you if you didn't. It was really, really bad.
And a couple of things that are important about this sequence is they need to tell you to change your password after they have done all these other things, because it doesn't help to change it before then. The password could still be captured. And the other interesting thing that I've seen, subtlety of this, is when you issue a certificate for a web page, it indicates, you know, who that is by the domain. So this is the certificate and the key for www.foo.com or whatever. But if you go to companies that have very elaborate websites, they'll often have customerservice.mybank.com and support.mybank.com. But the certificate may be issued to star.mybank.com. Now, the reason they have support.mybank.com and customerservice.mybank.com and all those different things is those are probably implemented on different servers. They might even be in totally different data centers being run by different companies, and that means the vulnerability status on any of them might be different. One of them might have not been vulnerable, one of them might have, but if they all have that same star.mybank.com certificate, it doesn't matter because the vulnerable one let the key out for everybody, which means all those passwords really need to be changed and the company needs to be following this procedure.
Yeah, and that's where you get into trouble is the main site who registered the star.com, they went and told their customers to do it, but all the other sites they had that weren't vulnerable, they said nothing to them. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there. Here's the thing you can do. You could just go change all your passwords, right? Regardless of who the vendor is, whether they told you or not, safe thing to do. What if they haven't patched?
Right.
That's a big problem, and we're going to get to that.
Well, and of course, the old, what's there's a meme going around right now that passwords are like underwear. Don't leave them out where people, don't leave it out where people can see it. Don't share it with other with others, right? And change it regularly. So change your passwords regularly, whether you need to or not.
Wow, that's good. I'm stealing that.
Yeah.
Did I just kick the power off by any chance? I saw. No, I'm just brain damaged. Okay. The other problem is, companies would go through this cycle and not generate new public-private key pairs. As a result, if their key was compromised, their new certificate is compromised. And so they had to go through this a second time, if they were even aware of it. That creates another problem, which actually puts a big impact on PKI, which we'll talk about here shortly. Okay. This is the most important thing, I think, out of this entire presentation, is PKI broken. The original PKI design was based on certain assumptions. Certificates would have a very short lifespan, like on the order of a year, right? Or even months. Browsers can check for certificate revocation. There's two ways they do that. Either a certificate revocation list, which you store locally, that you get updated periodically from whoever gives you your browser, although you can download them out of band on your own. Also, OCSP, which is a protocol for checking revocation. It doesn't give you as much detail as the CRL does, and the OCSP response you get actually has an expiration date itself. So after a few days it expires, it's no longer valid, and your browser will no longer honor it if you have it cached. The basic premise was certificate revocation would be rare compared to the number of issued certificates. And since the certificates have a very short lifespan, they have to stay on the certificate revocation list until they expire. Because if it's been compromised, as long as that certificate is valid time-wise, your browser will honor it unless it gets a notice that it's been revoked. Otherwise, it seems perfectly legitimate. So if somebody actually was able to not only steal the private key, but steal the certificate, then, which they could do with this particular bug, then they could actually pretend to be the host. So they could pretend to be your bank. They could do a man-in-the-middle attack, and you would be none the wiser. It would validate the certificate and say it's perfect. That is the bank. It was signed by the certificate authority. It's golden. That's what it would look like. So certificates typically have a lifespan of about 3 to 5 years. 3 years, the government recommends that you have a maximum 3-year lifespan, after which it expires automatically. However, Microsoft, in their great wisdom, said, oh no, depending on what the key length was used to generate the cert, if it's a long enough key length, your certificate could be good to 16 years. Now, actually, how long can you make a certificate? As long as you want, pretty much. Actually, I think if you run past the, what's the next date where the time runs out? We go from 32-bit to 64-bit.
2036.
Yeah, 2036. So you can have a certificate last to 2036, at which time it'll expire because the time rolls over. But now, 500,000 certificates had to be revoked. That's how many sites were vulnerable. That's a lot of sites. On top of that, some of them got the patch cycle wrong and had to do it 2 or 3 times before they got to, so they had to revoke their certificates multiple times. Or in the process of installing the certificates, they did something wrong and they had to revoke the certificate they just did because they did something wrong. That's not all that uncommon. GlobalSign, who is only one of hundreds of certificate authorities, their CRL list grew from before Heartbleed to from 22 kilobytes to 4.9 megabytes. That was in a matter of about a week after the bug came out. They went from 1,400 certificates to 133,000 certificates. Now that doesn't sound bad, 4.9 megabytes. How long does it take you to download 4.9 megabytes? You're on cable modem or ADSL, it's like that. What's the big deal? So what? CRLS, I downloaded it, no big deal, right? Yeah, there's only one problem. Cisco did an estimate in 2010 that there's 12.5 billion internet-connected devices. That's with a B, billion. Times 4.9 megabytes. As you notice, that's 61.25 petabytes that has to periodically be downloaded. Now, wait a minute. Why do I have to download it periodically? If I download it once, I'm golden, right? No, because everybody hasn't patched. People keep adding over time. They keep adding more sites to the list. So you have to keep downloading it. Now, that's one certificate authority. Since there are hundreds, multiply 61.25 petabytes downloaded approximately every 3 days to a week. Yeah, that's a whole lot of data. And all we're doing is checking certificate revocation. It kind of demonstrated that the basic assumption is certificate revocations would be rare, the CRLs would be small. That's a problem. There's also another problem. OCSP, which is a protocol for checking revocation, is relatively efficient because the size of the messages are much smaller than a CRL. However, browsers have that turned off by default. They don't do OCSP by default. The reason they don't is actually pretty important. And if it was turned on, it was set to what's called a soft fail, meaning if I can't verify, I let you go on anyway. Why do they do that? Anybody using wireless in hotel? Okay. Do you notice you have to go to a page first and say, here's my credentials or here's whatever? If that's HTTPS, you can't check the credentials until you're online. And if you're not online, you can't check your credentials. It's a catch-22. So if you have a hard fail coded in your OCSP protocol, what's going to happen is it will refuse to let you online to log into the page because it can't get the certificate check until you're logged in. It kind of breaks the internet. So people turn off hard fail and have soft fail. When it soft fails, it gives you no warning that it wasn't able. You might get a little icon or change in color of the icon up in your browser. How many people ever pay any attention to that? Well, people in here might, right? Okay. We're all professional paranoids. However, my mom, not so much, okay? She's lucky if she, you know, she says, the internet's broken. What do you mean? I can't get to this game site. The internet's down. It's like, no, mom, the site's down. What? No, the internet's down. Oh, no, I'm not having that conversation again, okay? So this is a very big problem. In addition, the OCSP expires about every 3 days at maximum. So that means you're constantly having, if you're caching this, you have to constantly go get it. That's also a whole lot of data. In addition, there aren't that many servers that you check for OCSP, which means if I DDoS the servers, I can essentially make it impossible for anybody on the entire internet to check for revocation. And if you're set to soft fail and I have your private key, guess what? You're owned, even if you did change your password. This is a little bit of a problem. At this point, people are going, yeah, this PKI isn't working so good. It works good as an encryption protocol. The encryption itself is good. It's just that you need to be able to check for revocation. And there's no real good, clean way to do that. Google, by the way, if you go to where it says has issues, that's a link to a site by one of the security guys at Google who explains in nauseating detail why and how OCSP is seriously hosed. And that's why, by the way, Google chose to include CRLs that they download automatically with their updates. And everybody said, you're crazy. And now they're not thinking they're so crazy anymore. Okay. By the way, it didn't just affect web servers. How many people own a phone? Congratulations, you're vulnerable. Not all cell phones use the OpenSSL libraries. How many of you own an iPhone? Congratulations, you're all vulnerable. Now, embedded devices. How many have a home router? Congratulations, you're probably vulnerable. Do you own any Cisco or Juniper equipment if you're commercial? Or some of us might actually have some in our basement. Okay, I know you're guilty. Yes, yeah, he's guilty. Yeah, congratulations, you're probably vulnerable. Cell phones, in fact, we'll get to this later, one of the incidents, a company was seriously owned through their cell phones being vulnerable. You've heard of these industrial control computers? Yeah, they're vulnerable. Yeah, they're vulnerable to everything. Yeah. kid with a snowball. They're vulnerable, you know. Now, client software, this is the other thing. You have software that uses SSL libraries. How many have used OpenVPN? You're vulnerable. Go patch. How about FreeRadius? If you've implemented Radius Server. If any of you have done, some of you, did you do that at work or at home? Work? Yes. Now, some of us are really, I haven't done this yet, but I really want to. I want to set up an enterprise single sign-on thing for my wireless and everything at home, and because I'm like crazy. And so I would do FreeRadius. Asterisk, anybody run a PBX, their own PBX? That's vulnerable. Curl, that's a command line tool for grabbing websites. How many have ever heard of this little program? You may not have heard of it, called Tor. Yeah, vulnerable. Basically, Tor said, EFF said, you might want to stay off the internet for a few days. And there are many, many, many more. That link for more will take you to an article at Wikipedia that lists a whole bunch of protocols and services that are vulnerable. How many of you are excited right now for Heartbleed? You know, just really, yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to go stab it in the heart is what you want to do. Now, here's a few articles that came out. Back in June 21st, now remember, this happened in when? April. Okay, June 21st, 300,000 systems were still vulnerable out of the 500,000. There was obviously this panicked rush to patch. No, they put IDSs in front of everything. So that even if you tested yourself to see if they were patched, you got a response that says, no, they're good. Basically, there was no way to know unless you actually did your own Heartbleed attack on them and actually started doing some of the things we talked about. We're down there where it says may not protect you. If you go to that link, there's a guy who walks through the procedure for actually constructing your own packets that will evade an IDS so you can test if they're really patched for Heartbleed. Okay. In July 18th, they came out and said, hey, by the way, those are in correct order. June 21st, they said 300,000 systems are still vulnerable. July 18th, they came out and said, oh, by the way, most industrial control systems are vulnerable. On July 29th, only 3% of the web servers of the top sites on the internet, corporate internet sites, were actually fixed. How many of you are feeling safe right now? Now, this is the one that'll scare the pants out. Thank you, Brian. Brian just sent me this just, when was that?
Yesterday.
This came out on the 25th, and I added it. Only half of the vulnerable sites are patched. And that's from back in April. Okay. And if you're hiding behind an IDS, guess what? You're not safe. So that means if the service you're using is hiding behind an IDS, you're not safe. Now, has anybody actually used this to attack somebody? Now, these are just a few. I didn't try to do an exhaustive list. The Canadian Revenue Agency, they were pwned bad, Heartbleed. There's this new evil Wi-Fi that does man-in-the-middle automatically that takes advantage of the Heartbleed attack to steal certs. And it's a self-contained little thing. You can go download, build it yourself, right? You should go home and try it. This is really dangerous. It can get you arrested. So do not do this at home. Go to your neighbor's house and try it. Okay. That's Cupid. And then the community health systems breach. I don't know if anybody heard about that. 4.5 million records were owned. Heartbleed. They hadn't patched and didn't have an IDS. But they hadn't patched. Aviva, which is an insurance company, they were pwned like hard via their iPhones. Yay, iPhones. Now, how do you test if things are patched? That's a problem. Well, I have to warn you, first, right up, you may get yourself thrown in jail for testing somebody else's site for Heartbleed because it is considered an attack because you actually have to attack them to test if they're vulnerable to see if they're patched or not. That could be a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So they could choose to go after you. So the best thing to do is use some third-party service who does it for you. That won't necessarily make you immune, but they're going to go after them first and they got more money than you. So that's probably the best way to do it. Not recommending you do that. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm definitely not your lawyer. Okay. If you go and say, Keith told me to do it, they're going to laugh at you. So there are tools that you can use to test for Heartbleed. This one here, this Heartbleed test at the top here, is actually a pretty good one. There are some that you can use their server. There's some you can download and run on your own if you want to test your own stuff internally. Qualys Labs has the SSL server test, which, by the way, Heartbleed aside, that is a really good test if you want to test how your security is set up for a site that you have, and it'll actually tell you what things you need to do to improve your security. It's actually pretty good. Very handy. CrowdStrike came out with a scanner. DigiCert has a certificate checker that will also test for it. If you go to that vulnerability testing services, there's a whole list on Wikipedia of other sites that carry these kinds of things. These top ones here are actually pretty good as sites go. In addition, if you go to the Codenomicon site we mentioned earlier, they have a link to their tester, and they'll test the site for you. And you'll notice that within about 3 days, roughly, of it being announced publicly, sites started testing clean all of a sudden. Good old IDS, okay? Now, you can also get plugins for your browser. There are Firefox plugins you can use for testing right from your browser. You can also get them for Chrome. Poor IE, he doesn't get any because he's terrible. You know IE Internet Exploder, you've heard of that, right? If you want, one of the things you can also do is you can go see if your company has issued an official announcement about their policy on Heartbleed. The simplest way to do that, if you go to the company site and try to search from there, good luck. Okay, the simplest way is you do this search on Google. You say Heartbleed site and the name of the site. Okay. By the way, the reason that example.com is in blue is I did not know this until I did this paper. There's actually an RFC for example URLs, and that's the official RFC example URL. And somebody actually registered that site and pays for it just so they can use it as an example. That's pretty cool. Somebody needs a life. That's okay. Linus's Law. How many of you have heard of that? A couple. I know everybody in here has heard this. Given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Or more formally, given a large enough beta tester and co-developer base, almost every problem will be characterized quickly, and a fix will be obvious to someone. That was said by who? No, it was actually Eric Raymond. And he attributed it to Linus. And what's interesting is Linus doesn't necessarily agree with this. It's really interesting article on Wikipedia if you want to read it. The idea is that when you put a lot of software out there that's open source, anybody can go read the source. But there's some challenges back and forth as to whether or not that's actually valid. Okay, these guys here, there are some that have never believed that to be true. If you go to that link, there's guys who say, oh, this is the most heinous statement ever made in programming. It's just evil. There are some that said we're just waiting for the proof to come out, and they believe that the Heartbleed bug proves that Linus's Law is not true, and those are these links. Then you have some that believe that the Heartbleed bug actually proves Linus's Law is true. Now, I have an opinion on this subject. I'm not here to tell you what I think is the truth, but you all ought to go check this out and decide on your own. But we are going to cover some of the issues here that they came up with. There are some that see both sides of the issue. They say, yes, there were problems, but yes, we can overcome them. These articles discuss that. Now, what's interesting is, what does Linus's Law mean? Does it mean that open source code will be bug free? No, it doesn't. However, when you read a lot of the arguments there, the straw man they'll use in the debate is that, hey, you promised us good code. The code had a bug in it. Linus's Law must not be true. No, Linus's Law says someone can find the bug because anybody can look at the source code. And if and when they do find the bug, people will crawl out of the woodwork and fix it pronto. Yeah. Or if you find it and you want to fix it, you can fix it yourself.
Well, and of course, anybody who works in software for any length of time knows there's no such thing as bug-free code. There's only code that you just haven't found the bugs in yet.
Now, I'm gonna pick on my friend JD, who he's not here. Okay, if he was, I'd have him tell you about it. He's a DC-404 member. He worked on the software development team for the space shuttle. The code they wrote for the space shuttle is considered to be the most bug-free code ever written by man. And it's not bug-free. In fact, there was a recent article that it's really, 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 really tight, good code, but it still has bugs. And that's using a methodology that is staggering, if you've ever heard his description of it.
It's really
in fact,
hard.
There's this really cool article that he posted on the DC404 mail list that talked about their software development methodology. It doesn't get any more rigorous than that, and the code is still not 100% bug-free. Okay. Not to mention, there's this little problem that you go and you write really good, tight code that might actually be, well, theoretically bug-free till the compiler gets it and optimizes it and takes out some of your modules and just throws them on the floor. That's a new problem that's coming out recently that we're discovering, that sometimes it'll throw out your security module and then your bug that you put the patch in isn't bug-free anymore. So another thing is, does open source mean that there will be a code audit? What do y'all think? No, somebody could look at it. And this was one of the things where people said, yeah, they could. Anybody, as the expression goes, anybody could have done this. Somebody should have, but he didn't show up. So nobody got the job, and he did a great one. So that's kind of what happened with this. Nobody other than the software developers themselves actually bothered to check code, and they missed it. And so, but how did this get found out? Somebody at Google was checking the code and said, oops. So if it were closed source, could they have checked the code? No. So unless the vendor themselves did it, or somebody reverse engineered your code, if they reverse engineered the code, which is a violation of what? The software license, yeah, which is under the DMCAA, might get you thrown in jail, just so you know. So that means it makes it impossible for other people to check the code. And this is one of the points of Linus's law, the way Eric explains it, is that it's possible to go check it. Doesn't guarantee somebody will, but you could if you wanted to.
Right.
Which it actually happened. That's how they found the bug. It just didn't happen as soon as they would like. So what happened is they said, because it took so long for it to be found, Linus's law is broken. You're going to have to decide for yourself whether or not that argument holds any water. Okay. Now, OpenSSL software development had a few problems. And you can get this off their webpage. That's where I got this. They had an RT backlog, their request ticket tracker backlog. They had all these trouble tickets and bug reports that were in that they were trying to wade through. There weren't that many developers. And there were a lot more people finding bugs than there were developers to fix them. Okay. They had incomplete and incorrect documentation. Have any of you ever read the OpenSSL documentation? Nobody?
Yeah.
Seriously, if you want a really good laugh, kind of like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy funny, go read their documentation and try to figure out how to implement their code.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Oh, I have a migraine.
This is a huge problem across a lot of open source projects. And the eyeball problem and the ticket backlog problem and the documentation problem all come from the same thing, which is you're relying on people who are interested in these things to help out. But people are going to help out with things that they're motivated for. And a lot of these things like OpenSSL people who work in software refer to them as plumbing. It's not a sexy piece of software. It's sort of the thing that you have to have. But I'd rather be working on this cool thing that does graphics and I use in my game or whatever. That's sexy. I'm going to work on that. Nobody wants to, work on something like OpenSSL or a web server or something like that because, all right, we just assume that those things work, right? And especially fixing bugs. It's like, oh, it's such a drudge thing trying to fix a bug. You got to duplicate the bug and da-da-da-da. It's hard work doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of times it just doesn't get done because people focus their attention elsewhere. There's a lot of open source projects. So even if we have millions of people who are willing to spend some time on it, it's going to get spent on a lot of different things and maybe not on the key things that we're all relying on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. How many of you want to build the next Minecraft? Right? That would be cool.
Yeah.
Right? How many of you want to build an SSL protocol? Not so many, right? That's your point.
Yeah.
And so also the library complexity. Their code tried to implement every doodad, thingamagadget, and thing that came along. rather than focusing on the absolute core essentials needed for SSL encryption. And so the problem is, yeah. Yes, we're going to get to that. Did everybody hear what he said? He asked if there's any companies that are actually trying to pay developers to do some of this stuff. And the answer is yes. As a result of this, that's exactly what's happening.
Hmm?
No, they got some. What? Oh. Yeah, pay attention. You have the mic of doom. Okay, here's the thing. They want you to talk into this crazy-looking mic here. And just don't put it in front of the speaker, or we all die. They want you to talk into the mic so it doesn't sound like me talking to a disembodied voice that they can't hear what the question is in the background. Now the library is extremely complex. They have inconsistent coding styles. There was no clear release plan. We'll get that when we can, sort of thing. Primarily due to lack of resources. And you got to realize, these guys are taking a huge amount of heat for stuff they're doing voluntarily. How many of you would code like this voluntarily and get this kind of heat and keep doing it? None of us, right? They didn't have a platform strategy, and they didn't have a published security strategy. Now, this is their own review that they published after the event. Now, as a result of this, because it's open source, there are options available that are not possible with closed source software unless they make it open source. The Linux Foundation is going to fund a security audit with two full-time developers for OpenSSL. Now, it's funded through the Linux Foundation, but to go back to your question, it's being funded by major corporations. Basically, a bunch of corporations like Microsoft and Google and Facebook and people like that got together and said, you know, we use this stuff. This is the plumbing that makes our service possible, and we're not paying anything for it. Maybe we should invest a little money in something that's such a critical resource to us. And so they're actually putting money up to help develop and maintain this open source software. In addition, there's a core infrastructure initiative with the Linux Foundation, and that's a spinoff of this also, where they're going to go pick a list of open source software projects that are like OpenSSL, that are foundational to the plumbing that makes the internet possible, and also focus money and resources on this. We're talking millions and millions of dollars here. So yes, they are addressing this, and this came out of this. So this has been touted by some as evidence that the open source model in Linus's Law actually does work, where others are saying, no, this should have happened already under Linus's Law, and therefore it doesn't work. It's a failure. We should go back to closed source. You're going to have to read the arguments for yourselves and debate, because there's very smart people on both sides arguing both sides of this case. Okay. Now, another option you have that you don't have in closed source, you can fork the project. Now, I know what that sounded like to all you, a fork like you eat with, okay? Golly, get your mind out of the gutter, people at home or in the cheap seats. You should have been here in person. There are two. OpenBSD said, heck with it, we're going to do our own, and they forked the project. And also, Google did Boring SSL, and they forked the project. So there will be multiple sources for this, which will make things just so much simpler. The interesting thing is, OpenSSL tried to do everything in the kitchen sink. These two other projects are sticking to the bare necessities of what it takes to do SSL. So there may not be 100% compatibility if you're relying on some feature of OpenSSL that's not implemented in these two. So I would highly recommend, if you use either of these two options, you test like crazy before you deploy it. Not that their code's bad, but they may not implement something you're relying on. Now, one of the other big issues was responsible disclosure. And basically, some say that this was a textbook case of responsible disclosure. Forbes had an article. Bruce Schneier came out and said, yeah, these guys did a nice job of disclosure. Cloudflare agreed with it. Nagios even said, oh, thank goodness this was responsible disclosure. However, there were some others that said, you've got to be kidding me. If this is responsible disclosure, I'm the Pope. And so they said, no, absolutely not. So eWeek and Arbor Networks both came out and said, under no circumstances is this ever responsible disclosure. This is a disgrace. It was so controversial that the Sydney Morning Herald decided, you know what, we're going to publish a timeline of exactly what happened so you can make up your own mind. Now, I've condensed this down. If you go to that link, you can read in nauseating detail, and it's an excellent article. It really covers every possible nuance, who discovered, when they discovered it, how they discovered, who they talked to, what kind of sandwich they were eating when they talked to them. Get him the microphone. Yeah, when he raised her hand, run right over there.
Here he comes.
We're talking about doing disclosure. What is the fine line for you being a corporation saying, okay, well, we need to go ahead and release this information to the general public compared to, okay, we're going to release it, but in doing so, we might cause mass hysteria?
Well, that's the whole debate. In fact, if you a really interesting Wikipedia, once again, by the way, is Ilanka here this year?
Yeah.
Okay, Ilanka Dunham, you need to go to her talk. Is she doing a Wikipedia talk?
Yes.
Yeah, go to her Wikipedia talk. She's a Wikipedia admin, and their articles are actually pretty good. And the one on responsible disclosure really discusses a lot of those issues. And that's part of the problem is, when do you come out and disclose? Now, any of you remember back in 2008, the Kaminsky attack on DNS?
Yes.
That was considered by many of us to be a textbook case responsible disclosure, where he went secretly and told like anybody who had a stake in this. He even got researchers on board who were doing DNS research. There were some at Georgia Tech Information Security Center that were involved in this, and they didn't tell anybody anything. And they found out what the problem was. They got patches out. They had everything ready. And before they disclosed, they were completely ready for everybody to patch instantly. Okay. Now, some would say, yeah, but that took you 8 months. And in that 8 months, bad guys could have found this, and they could have been owning your system, and you wouldn't know. And so there's this thing of, even though some people say, man, this is the best you can do, there's others saying, yeah, but you should have told us anyway. We wanted to know, even if there wasn't a patch, and I was vulnerable for 8 months. But if you the question is, if you tell people, you also tell the bad guys. So there's this trade-off between,
right,
if I notify this, and the bad guys didn't know it, they do now. There's also the assumption of, hey, if I don't say anything, the bad guys won't know. Well, you're assuming the bad guys don't know, where more often than not, they do. So that's the trade-off, and there's really no good answer. The bottom line, if you're a corporation, is you want to do whatever gets you the least liability, which, as the customer of the corporation, may not be in your best interest. It'll keep them out of court and out of jail, but it may really screw you over. That happens quite often. And when that happens, we say that's irresponsible disclosure and we get really mad. Well, it depends. Are you a corporate stockholder or are you a customer? It depends on what side of the fence you're standing on, right?
Well, and one of the things that is frustrating to those of us who work in the software industry, and I, you know, worked at companies where we had been told of bugs and we have to work on stuff, and you see a lot of folks who research these things getting very frustrated. And, you know, it's easy to say, hey, look, you know, I told Microsoft about this bug 3 weeks ago, and they have $45 billion sitting in the bank. Why haven't they fixed it yet? And it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what goes on in a software development process. You know, it's easy to say, well, I have a Linux server, and as soon as this patch came out, I put it on my Linux server, and I was fixed in a day. It's a lot harder when you have, you know, you have somebody like Google who literally has millions of servers all over the world. They cannot roll patches out instantly to all those servers. When you're talking about software changes, those software changes have to be integrated into code bases that are often thousands or millions of lines of code, which means they have to then be tested against all sorts of use cases of how that software is used to make sure that the patch does not break something else, and it often does. And all that stuff has to happen before a patch can be available and it can be disclosed. So it often takes weeks or sometimes even months for this stuff to be done. And you see a lot of researchers getting frustrated and say, oh, I'm going to release it anyway because it's crazy that this took 6 weeks. And it's like, it's not crazy that it took 6 weeks. It takes that long to do the work to make sure that these things don't, are that the fix isn't worse than the problem.
Well, I was just going to add a comment to what you're saying. I mean, and you also have the human factor too, where you have, like, say, a different, like a CEO or CIO that wants to have that special integration of that application and say, hey, it would be really nice to have that. And then you have to go back and then just try to work that in to try to appease,
right,
appease your bosses. So that's that can put a lot of emphasis on the timetable that you're working on too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the regression testing is really, how many of you saw the notice in this last Microsoft patch cycle? There's been 4 patches now that cause catastrophic failure. 3 caused blue screen of death, and they were a patch for like a font problem or a language problem.
Yeah.
And then there's this other one that just came out, I haven't even finished reading it yet, that causes some major hassle. And that you, IE, it was some IE patch that breaks IE, well, like we use it anyway, right? Unless you're going to your bank, because it only works with IE. Well, what if you realize, haven't you gone to the hospital and looked at the operating system on that sonogram machine or the x-ray machine, or it's Windows, right? Or XP, right? What happens when they run out of patch and the x-ray machine miscalculates your x-ray and gives you a dose 10,000 times more than what they dialed in?
Superpowers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're going to be the real Spider-Man at Dragon Con. That's
superpowers,
right.
Superpowers. Yeah.
Talk about climbing the walls. It'll be awesome. Hey, you know, everybody wants to get a picture next to you, but they don't want to stand next to you because you're like, you know. So this is a real problem, and it doesn't matter whether you patch instantly or you wait 6 months and regression test like crazy. You're going to break somebody, and they're going to be mad.
Yeah.
It's going to cause some damage, and people don't like, they want perfect. We don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world where we rely heavily on trust. How many of you trust that little white line on the freeway to keep the car on the lane next to you from making a hard left turn at 80 in front of you, right? It isn't. It's just a guideline to remind him to stay in his lane. We really trust that the other guy's going to do the right thing. I trust that this isn't a Coke, but if this were a Coke, I trust that if I drink it, it won't kill me. But if it does, there's a system involved that if it kills me, my family will be very wealthy. Unfortunately, I'll still be dead, but there's a checks and balances. It doesn't guarantee, but it does promote, as general, a positive outcome. And that's what we have to try to do. And it's that fine balance you have to work with. This incident brought up a lot of questions on that. And a lot of the fallout that we've discussed today actually demonstrates that the reaction is actually positive. It's actually going to improve things. Now, it wasn't good that this happened, but the way we reacted to it demonstrated that the system does kind of work, although that, in my opinion, PKI has really got a problem. So let's talk about this timeline. In March 21st, Neil Mehta, thank you, of Google Security. You said he used to work for ISS.
Yeah, there's actually a big Atlanta connection for this whole thing, starting with Neil. Neil used to work for Internet Security Systems, now IBM Internet Security Systems, here in Atlanta for about 5 years, a long time ago. He now works for Google. And other people who've done some of the follow-on research, like the research about how IDSs miss this and stuff like that, are all folks who used to work or still currently work up at Internet Security Systems right here in Atlanta.
Yeah, one of the guys, the guy who wrote the article about OCSP not working very well and having issues is a Google researcher also. I don't know if he worked for, he wrote Violet, I forget the name of his blog. It's the link's in there. Same day, Google patches their own systems, right? They, in turn, 10 days later, notify someone out of band, notifies Cloudflare, and they instantly patch their systems. The patch was very relatively simple patch. It wasn't that difficult, okay? Google, on the first, notifies OpenSSL. Now, you notice how long that is, like 11 days. That's almost 2 weeks before they told OpenSSL. Some people were saying, why did you wait so long? Well, it turns out that the person they wanted to talk to, remember, there aren't very many developers there, he was on vacation and was unreachable. That's kind of a problem. So is that really their fault or not? You'll have to judge that on your own. Independently, on the second, Codenomicon discovers the vulnerability. and they proceed to register a domain name, heartbleed.com, or was it org? It's, I think it's .com, com, right?
Yeah.
And come up with this really cool logo, right? But they haven't told anybody. Now, some people think that that was really, really bad form on their part, okay? But I read this one article that kind of changed my opinion on that, and I'll explain that. On the third, they Codenomicon tells the Cybersecurity Center of Finland, where they're located, and said, hey, we got this serious vulnerability. That's kind of like US CERT, right? Finland doesn't tell anybody, okay? On the fourth, Akamai got notified by an anonymous member of OpenSSL, whoever that was, tells Akamai. Now, most of you don't know who Akamai is. How many do? Wow, everybody, never mind then. You know who Akamai is. Akamai found out anonymously by somebody from OpenSSL. They turn around and ask the, or no, they didn't. Akamai patches, which is a really, really good thing because, like, everybody uses them. Now, on the 6th, Finland finally tells US CERT, hey, we need a CVE for this really serious vulnerability. Okay, what's the vulnerability and what package? We can't tell you that, but it's really, really important you generate a CVE. A CVE kind of is like a placeholder that says, hey, there's this vulnerability and we're going to fill in details later. Usually they say there's a vulnerability in this package, details to come. And they try to give you as much notice as possible. Well, in this case it was, there's a vulnerability, details to come. And they didn't want to tell them what it was. So, but they don't give them any details. Later on, same day, OpenSSL notifies Red Hat and authorizes. Now, this is the guy that was on vacation. Now, you notice there was a delay there of about 5 days, right? Because he was on vacation. He notifies Red Hat and authorizes them to tell other members of a non-disclosure group that they have with other Linux distros. So they have a list. So they posted to the list under an NDA saying, hey, there's this vulnerability, it's bad, requires an NDA, get back to us if you're interested. As you can see, four Linux distros, which is about four out of what, 10,000 something, you know, get back to them and respond and say, yes, we're willing to sign an NDA, tell us what's going on. What's good is that these are foundational. At least Red Hat and Debian are and FreeBSD are very foundational. Lots of other builds are based off them, like Kubuntu and all those guys, and even Arch Linux. Everybody is based off of Debian, it seems. Somehow on the 7th, Facebook finds out and patches. So all your wall posts are safe. This is good. And finally on the 7th, OpenSSL publishes an advisory. Now this is what, 20 days? Almost, we're talking almost a month after basically the infrastructure of the internet is seriously broken and all the Russian mob own all your servers. All your servers are belong to the Russian mob. There you go, great meme for you. So this is, yeah.
Here comes the mic.
So it's about 20 days, but how long since it actually was in the code?
2 years.
Right.
All right. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It was in the code for 2 years before these researchers noticed it.
Right.
There is a lot, I didn't put this in the slides, but there is a great deal of debate as to whether or not the NSA knew and was actually using it to pwn people, and the FBI for that matter. But that's all conjecture because...
Or even worse guys.
Yeah, and the NSA, which all of you know stands for No Such Agency, vehemently denies having known this, and the president has assured us that that's true. Yeah, right. Okay. Next question. Yeah.
Well, my question with you being on the security side of the house, I know when I was working for the MSSP last year, that we saw a lot of traffic coming from China Unicom and China Telecom ISP blocks, and also a subset of Russia. Where exactly did you see a lot of traffic coming into Georgia Tech, if at all, for Heartbleed attacks?
Unfortunately, I just handled College of Computing. I didn't talk to the guys at the campus level who would have watched the border firewall and our IDS to tell us how many it was. However, was it Ars Test? Ars Technica, I think, published an article. Oh, yes. In fact, it's this link. The one where we said that there's half of the systems aren't patched.
Yeah.
If you follow that, I won't go back there. If you follow that link, that article actually talks about the actual attack rates. It takes you to an IBM paper, IBM ISS, and they actually did a paper and talked about the number of attacks per day. And they were talking about on this 300,000 or 400,000 attacks a day. Yeah, it's gone down, but they're still having them, obviously, because systems are getting owned. Okay, but it also means if they can detect it. And that's part of the problem, is the detection mechanism is kind of flawed. So let me go back to, who had the next question? Go ahead.
So kind of along those lines, presumably large SSL sites, they have sniffer traffic from before the vulnerability was actually found. Do you know if anybody's tried to go back and look at those logs to see if there's evidence that people were trying to exploit it before the 21st? Because that would kind of conclusively say somebody knew.
It depends. I know we keep full packet captures. Some of the researchers have full packet captures. But if you think about it, we have like 10 gig pipes to the internet at Georgia Tech. I can't, I don't have enough storage for all that kind of traffic.
Those are huge volumes of data. And it's exactly the same problem with security cameras. You know, most security cameras, they only keep a day or a week or whatever. And then they look for, you know, and had an incident occurred, then they can go back. And usually you'll find out, you know, in a security situation that something happened that you need to go look fairly quickly. You're not worried about, you know, 6 months ago, because the chances are, you know, no one will.
If you do find it, then that says somebody knew.
Yeah,
and that's the question. People were saying, hey, William, it's been out there for 2 years. Does anybody use this? Everybody said, how would we know? It doesn't generate any logs. So unless, like you were saying, unless we have full packet captures, we don't know. Now, on the... Yeah, we need to wrap up here. So, basically, that was pretty much it. Okay. So the idea is, what do you think? Was it responsible disclosure? Was it not the responsible disclosure? I could see both sides of it. These are a very small team of people that are massively overworked and doing it as volunteers, and everybody's relying on them, but not giving them any resources to do it. That's a cheap shot, if you ask me. And the fact that the industry has responded positively to actually fixing the problem, and not necessarily, they're saying, yeah, that was bad how you did that, but we can understand how that happened that way. Maybe we can help you fix that, rather than just throwing them under the bus. I thought that was kind of cool. Now, if you want this presentation and all the links, go to that site there at the top, and all my presentations there, including this one, in both PDF and whatever this is, PowerPoint. And also, you notice all the links from this presentation are included, so that if you can't actually link, let me go back, people are taking pictures, let me go back to that. I went past it. Hold on, let me freak your camera. There you go. I have links, all the links are there. There's like 86 links in this slide.
Yeah, there's a lot of good links.
And I actually had to read them all to write this. So I'm going to go home and sleep for about 3 days. from boredom, from reading all these reports, because some of them are pretty bad. And Brian, thank you, Brian. Brian said, one of the questions is how many sites are patched or not patched? And there's been, the last report was the one from back in June. I was hoping to find a newer one and couldn't find one. And Brian coughed one up for me yesterday while I was in the middle of another incident. So thanks, Brian. Do you have anything else to add?
I just repeat, the line that you liked. Just remember that passwords are like underwear. change them often. And, that's part of your defense as an end user.
Yeah, and use a password database like KeePass or LastPass. I like KeePass. It's offline. It's very nice. It's open source. It's great. Doesn't cost anything. On those questions they ask you, your cat's favorite name, whatever, lie. Okay? Make them all different. Let the database keep track of it all. So I guess we're out of time. So thank you all for coming, and have a good time.